Okay. Yeah, first, thank you for the invitation, and it's very nice to visit KITP and this beautiful campus. I will talk about a paper, my paper on this paper on archive, and this is a joint work with Yin-Hsien Lin, my collaborator. And I will talk about bootstrapping 2D CFTs in the semi-custom. And first, CFT is a very important ingredient of studying either quantum field theory, string theory, and gravity. And in some sense, CFTs are simpler than the more general QFTs. And in the sense that CFT can be defined in an axiomatic way. And the way of defining it is first to specify a set of defining data. And this is a set of primary operators, and those are the operators that are annihilated by the special conformal generators. And also a set of structure constants among these operators. And given these defining data, and you can construct, in principle, all the correlators in CFT. And the construction is basically given by a sum over the conformal block. And these conformal blocks are one for each primary operator, and the sum is weighted by the structure constants. And in general, for a higher point function, there can be many ways of constructing it by using the defining data. And the consistency of the theory will put constraint on this defining data. And this constraint usually called the closing symmetry. And so it's possible to use this constraint to try to classify or solve for a particular CFT. And this is what conformal bootstrap program is going to do. It is aiming to do. And it's try to use closing symmetry to either classify all the CFTs or solve some particular CFTs. And the conformal bootstrap program achieved very huge success in '80s on solving and classifying 2D rational CFTs. And this was done by Belevin, Polyakov, Zamlachkov, and Kamizik, and many other follow-up people. If you try to include some more theory into a game, then for example, if we want to consider higher dimensional CFT or 2D irrational CFTs, and then the closing equation quickly becomes very complicated. It will be a set of equations involving infinitely many variables, and the number of equations also goes to infinity. And a systematic way of starting this set of equations is not known. But even there are these difficulties, people can still make progress. And some recent developments are first given by some numerical studies of this closing equation, and people can get some bounds on the operator dimension and also the structure constants. And this was done by studying the bootstrap equation numerically and using some convex extremization method. And this was done by this group of people, Ratazzi, Rocky, and some other people. And there's another approach, is more analytically. And since the entire bootstrap equation is very complicated, you can try to take some limit such that the equation can simplify. And basically, there are two types of limit that people have considered. One is considered Lycombe limit, that you basically kind of fix. So for example, if you consider four-point function, you can fix the position of three points and then take the other operator very close to Lycombe. And there is another limit that people have considered is about the theory it's on some large N theory. And these theories are the theory such that you have a parameter N and you can take to be very large, and such that in this limit the dual theory side becomes some weakly coupled gravity. And this particular limit was started by especially a group of people over here in KITP. And there are also many other approaches to this problem. So in this talk, I will mainly focusing on studying the Bootstrap equation analytically, and by taking a particular limit, and that's the semi-classical limit. And I will focus on 2D CFT. The semi-classical limit of 2D CFT is actually motivated from holography. So the holography duo of 2D CFT would be a gravity theory on ADS3, and the gravitational constant in ADS3 would roughly by the analysis of Brown-Hanold would be proportional inverse of the CFT central charge. And the spectrum of the gravity theory just very naturally fall into roughly two classes. So you will have a light spectrum, and these are the given by the excitation in the bulk that the energy does not scale with the central charge. And there is a heavy spectrum that are given by the excitation in the bulk that energy scale with the central charge. So the example of the light spectrum are consists of basically perturbative string states or some boundary graviton states. And an example of heavy spectrum are basically non-perturbative states, and there can be some deep bands. And these states are irresponsible for the black hole microstates. And if we want to examine some dynamics of these heavy states, we would like to basically zoom in to this heavy spectrum. And a way to do that is basically taking the central charge to be large, but you also want to take the operator dimension to be large, and you fix the ratio between the operator dimension and the central charge. And this quantity, I will call it M. Just take it, so basically taking C to be large and fix M. That's the ratio between H and C.
But and couldn't you form a black hole by just taking lots of quanta of light fields? It looks like you're going to focus on the very heavy fields.
Yeah, that's possible. You can form a black hole by taking very many light fields, but after you form a black hole, then the states, the black hole microstates are the heavy states.
It's like the larger limit. Take of order M quanta.
Sure. But you're saying the microstates of the black hole, I mean, the black hole's a very heavy object,
yes.
And so it's going to have a lot of energy.
Yes.
But this is what's always true. The degeneracy of the primary operator explains the black hole entropy. So, I mean, the correction of this tiny gravity fluctuation doesn't explain the black hole entropy. So this is the reason why he said that, yeah, the black hole microstates mainly come from the primaries.
Yeah, a black hole state is a mixed state, and it consists of many pure states, and there are many consists of the energy of the C states. Okay, and
the large C limit. In what ways does it differ from the large N limit?
So in the usual large N limit, people take N large but still focus on light states, and that still corresponds to some very light perturbative particles that in the ADS space. But right now, I want to also take the energy of the excitation to be very large when I take the large N limit. So in higher dimension, you can also take similar limit that you, for example, n equals 4 Swyam, you can take larger n, and also the energy goes like, I think in this case, will be of order n squared. And but in higher dimension, you do not have this larger Virasoro symmetry group to use. And but in two dimension, you have this advantage that you have Virasoro symmetry. And so it's possible you can have more control on these heavy states. So for example, one of the nice thing happens in this semi-classical limit is that if you consider endpoint function, and you take the single charge to be large, and also the operator of this endpoint function, the dimension to be large, then the endpoint function would have this very nice perturbative expansion. First, you will have basically a summing over all the saddle points, and also for each saddle point, you have a classical contribution and one loop contribution and two loop and so on. And at generic point of coordinates x1 to xn, the correlation function will be only dominated by a single saddle point. This means that this sum will be just dominated by a single sum, which this superscript I is the largest one. And but when you vary this coordinate x, so the correlation function can exhibit some phase transition that's given by some discontinuous jump between different dominant saddles. And the goal of the bootstrap program will be try to determine the phase structure of the in my case I will consider 4-point function. So I will try to determine the phase structure of 4-point function in a coordinate symmetric basically near a coordinate symmetric point. And also I will try to partially solve this classical and one loop PI and the QI for the dominant saddle.
So is this general saddle point expansion something you can derive directly in whole field theory?
So
we
cannot quite derive it, and we will take this as an assumption, but we consider many examples and see that this assumption is a reasonable assumption to make.
A saddle point usually refers to an integral. Is a saddle point of a sum? And in what sense is it a saddle point?
Oh. So, okay, I will talk about this later, and you can. Let me see. So, okay, basically, if you consider large central charge limit, and this I would roughly becomes an integral, and the saddle point is in that sense is. Okay. So the plan of this talk is okay. First, I will briefly review the conformal bootstrap, and then consider a bootstrap in the semi-classical limit. And as I said, I would try to determine the phase structure that near and also away from the cosine symmetric point. And I will also talk about that we can partially determine this classical and one loop piece, and the formula for that will be very similar to a Cauchy formula, and we call them the generalized Cauchy formula, but it's a formula on a structure constant, and then I will apply this technique to a particular 4-point function, that's the Z2 twist fields correlator, and in that case, I can reproduce some old results. First is the bound by Hellman, and the other is the original Cauchy formula, but with some higher order corrections. And then I will talk about some future directions. So so first about a review of the conformal bootstrap. So we will consider a 4-point function of identical operators. And conformal symmetry will fix this 4-point function to be basically this form, and we have some conformal structure, and times a general function of x. X is the closed ratio that's given by x 1-2 times x 3-4 divided by x 1-4 and x 3-2, and this function f, the conformal structure only depends on the fact that you have conformal symmetry. And this function f depends on which CFT you have. And that in particular depends on the spectrum of the primary and also the structure constants. And in this talk, I would basically keep the anti-holomorphic part of the theory implicit. And basically this, I will not write the variable x bar and h bar. They are there, but I just do not write them. And to see how this function f depends on this the CFT data, the thing we can do is try to do the operator product expansion. So we take x1 to be very close to x2, and then we can expand this two operator in terms of a basis of only local operators. And all are the operators that appear in the sigma sigma OPE. And this C sigma sigma O is the structure constant. And that's part of the defining data of a CFT. And this function beta it can be determined purely from conformal symmetry. And it takes this form. It basically just sum up the descendants of a particular primary O. So if we plug this OPE into the four-point function, so we actually need to consider x1, x2 OPE and also x3, x4 OPE and plug these two OPE into the four-point function, we can get this formula. So we basically get the structure constant square, given by this, and times a function that can be determined just using conformal symmetry. And this function, curly F, is called the conformal Braque. In particular, in this case, it's Virasoro Braque because I also use the Virasoro symmetry, not just conformal symmetry. And it can, the expression form of this function F is unknown, but it can be computed order by order in an X expansion in a very efficient way. So the closing symmetry of the four-point function is that we can consider different kinds of different ways of taking OPE. For example, we can take x1 to be very close to x3 and x2 very close to x4. This gives us another way, and also there's another way that's x1 very close to x4 and x2 very close to x3. And these two different ways will give us two extra expansion in the function f of x. And but all these expansions will have the same expansion coefficient. That's the structure constant. And this relation can be summarized in terms of this equation. F of x equals to f of 1 minus x and equals x to the minus 2 h sigma times f of 1 over x, or in this diagrammatic way. And this is something like we take x1 very close to x2 and do expansion, and this equals to x1 very close to x3 and do the operator product expansion. Okay. So now I would apply the technique of the conformal bootstrap that I talked about to a CFD in the semi-classical limits. So the first thing to notice in a semi-classical limit is that if you consider the conformal Braque and take C to be very large and fix the ratio between dimension and the central charge, you get this very nice semi-classical expansion. You have a classical piece that's given by this function f, and also one root piece, and also higher order expansion. So by knowing the conformal Braque, you can you can do the expansion in x on both sides and match term by term. That's how we get the function f and g. And the m variable is recall that is given by the dimension over the central charge. And so in this talk, this talk will mostly be analytic, and the only numerics come into to these two properties. So we numerically observe these two properties on the function f. And so this is only numerics because we can only compute the function f order by order in x. And we just compute it to certain high power, and then we can just numerically check many data points and see that these two properties are indeed satisfied. So the first property is that if we take x derivative on on the function f. So this function f, I will call the classical conformal block. And the g of 0, I will call it one loop conformal block. And this, the derivative of x of the classical conformal block will be a, it is a monotonically decreasing function in the variable m. So m is the dimension of a central charge of the intermediate operator. And it's monotonically decreasing, and it equals 0 exactly once. And okay, so this property can be very easily seen from just if you just consider scaling block, and this property is actually obvious. The scaling block is it is a block that you use only the scaling symmetry, but not even a conformal symmetry or very solid symmetry. And scaling block is just one term that fs equals x to h minus 2 h sigma. And if you use that formula, you get this fs is given by its log. So if you take one x derivative, the log becomes 1 over x. The log of x becomes 1 over x. And if I restrict to a region that x is within the interval 1, 0, then this term is positive. And you have something minus m, so it's basically monotonically decreasing. And basically close 0 exactly once at m equals to 2m sigma. And the second property I will use later is this one. So I consider the differences of two classical blocks at two different value of this m, the dimension of the intermediate primary divided by a central charge. And I order this m such that m2 is larger than m1. And if that's the case, this combination is also monotonically decreasing in this interval x from 0 to 1. And this property is also very easy to see from the scaling block. If you take the differences, and the first term just cancel out, and you will have you have m1 minus m2 times log of x. And one minus m2 is negative by this condition. And log of x is an increasing function, and so this will be decreasing.
So when you say you checked that you verify, so did you use recursion relation or you saw?
Yeah, I first used recursion relation compute function f to some certain high power in x, and then just plug some numerical value for m sigma m and x, and then I can check that these two.
Computed order by order in x.
Yes.
Around
x equals 0. And I think it's true that the radius of conversion of x is larger than I think at least up to 1 is still within the radius of conversion of this policy.
At x equals 0, there's a logarithmic singularity.
No, the log singularity appears at x equals 1. And x equals 0 is analytic.
Except for your scaling blocks.
Oh, sorry. This is only because I take, so f is analytic, but if I take log, then that log piece appears. But this is kind of a fake branch cut. OK. So by our previous this assumption that the n-point function goes like this has this form, and then because conformal block also has this semi-classical expansion form, then this basically tells us that the structure constant must also have this semi-classical expansion form.
When you're taking this limit, right, the m becomes a continuous variable?
Yeah, basically. That's why I said that the sum basically becomes an integral. And
it's a sum point in that case.
Sorry?
Can you make that more explicit? Or
you mean,
is there some integral representation?
No, now I know of. Yeah. I don't
know. Now you're trying to solve for theories.
Okay, so then I just combine with the combine the combo block with the structure constant. I can form this function f, and the closing equation basically take this form to leading order in 1/c expansion. And so at generic closed ratio, the 4-point function only dominated by a single saddle point, but here I still allowed the possibility that you can have multi-saddle points. And this function S is defined by basically P minus F over 6, basically the structure constant minus the classical common block. And the next thing I will do is I will take this equation and do expansion around the coordinate symmetric point x equals 1/2. And it will basically get this form. And so basically you want to take some derivative of this equation and then evaluate it at x equals 1/2. And you can see that if I take x derivative, it can either hit S or G. And but if you take derivative on S, you will pull down an order of C. So that will be more dominant than if you take derivative on G. So if I take 2j minus 1 derivative, then the thing I will get is I'll pull down 2j minus 1 of this f prime. F prime is denoted by taking x derivative on the function f, and there will be no derivative on g. So because this equation is symmetric under x to 1 minus x exchange. Anti-symmetric under x to 1 minus x exchange. So the even derivative would just automatically vanishes. The only non-trivial information are on the r derivatives. And basically get this equation. And j can be any integer that's larger than 1. And here I still allow the possibility that you can have multi-dominant saddle points. And so suppose
you only have one saddle point, then that prime vanishes, right?
Yes. If you just have one saddle point, F prime vanishes. So I will talk about that later. That's actually quite important. So that basically tells you that if you only have one saddle point, the value of M is just purely determined by conformal symmetry. So and for now I assume that you have N plus one saddle points. And this basically just tell you that because all the classical part of the dominant saddle point should are the same, so you get basically this trivial equation. And now, so I assume that you have n plus one saddle points, and you actually have infinitely many equations because this j can be arbitrary positive integer, and But I would just restrict ourselves to a smaller set of equations such that j run from 1 to n plus 1. And you can actually show that if you can solve these n plus 1 equations, then all the remaining equations are just automatically satisfied. So now this equation reduced to a homogeneous linear system of equations. And you have this n plus 1 times n plus 1 matrix is given by this f prime, and also n vector. So I would treat these as variables, and these are some coefficients you want to solve this homogeneous linear equation of these variables. And this basically tell you that if you want to have non-trivial solutions, the determinant of this matrix must be zero. And also, by the property one that I talked about, This f prime is a monotonically decreasing function in the variable m, and you also use this property, and the determinant equals zero condition basically just give this condition that the saddle point must pair up. So here I order the value m of the saddle point such that m hat 0 is less than m hat 1 is less than m hat n. And this tells you is that m hat 0 should pair up with m hat n, and m hat 1 should pair up with m hat n minus 1. And their f prime are the same variable with opposite sign. And so you then plug this into that equation, and you can solve this n vector. And solution is also given by this paired up form. So this basically tell you that not only the classical piece of these saddle points are the same, the one loop the one loop contribution of the saddle point are also the same for the two saddle points that are paired up. Now we can try to go slightly away from the saddle points and do some linear approximation. So basically, I move epsilon among the way from the saddle points, and because this f prime is a monotonically decreasing function, so which means that the x derivative of s is a monotonically increasing function, and so this function evaluated at m hat n will be the largest, and evaluated at m hat 0 is the smallest one. So if you move positively away from it, from a Poisson symmetric point, the one with largest derivative will dominate, and if you move some infinitesimally negative amount away from the set, from a Poisson symmetric point, the smallest derivative guy will dominate. And there's still one possibility that you just have one set of points, and that's just if that's the case, then no matter you move positively away from the Poisson symmetric point or negatively away from the saddle point, then this one would just continue dominate in this small interval. And for this case, also tell you that there is a phase transition at the Poisson symmetric point. Okay, so this is just what I just said. And so m hat, if you just have one saddle point, then this m hat is determined by the Poisson symmetry. And also, because f prime is monotonically decreasing function, and this will tell you that m zero hat should be smaller than m hat and smaller than m hat n. So this property will actually be important for the discussion later on. So here is just some infinitesimally away from the Poisson symmetric point. If I try to move finitely away from the Poisson symmetric point, and we would like to see that what's the thing that we can still say on the phase structure of the 4-point function. So actually we can have a bound on the dominant saddles at the point away from the Poisson symmetric point. So that's given by basically this graph. So I would denote the dominant saddle by m hat of x, and x is the closed ratio, and I would restrict to the region from 0 to 1. And if I in this region, and I can show that the m of the dominant saddle should be smaller than this value m hat, and this m hat is just can be just purely determined by conformal symmetry. And if you at the other region, the dominant saddle would have larger m than the m hat. So the way to prove this is actually quite simple. You first assume the contrary. So this means that the 4-point function is dominated by m star that's larger than m hat at some value x star that's smaller than 1/2 the Poisson symmetric point. And this basically means that the classical piece, the function S evaluate the class at M hat star larger than basically all the M, but I will restrict to only M is smaller than M hat. And if this is true, then recall that S equals to P minus F over 6. And you just turn that equation into this one. And then I will use the property 2 that I show you. The property 2 basically means tell that this function is monotonically decreasing when you increase x. So I increase x from some value smaller than 1/2 to some value very close to 1/2. So I get this inequality. But recall that our previous conclusion, if you go from some value smaller than 1/2 to something very close to 1/2, the dominant saddle should become some value m hat that's smaller, m hat 0 that's smaller than m hat, but here if this inequality is true, then this tells us that if you move close to the Korean symmetric point, the four point is still will be dominated by M star that's larger than M hat. So this is a contradiction. And these are about the fake structure that we can get from the Cosine equation. And the next, I will try to use the Cosine equation to partially solve the classical piece and the one loop piece of the structure constant. So, at some generic point of the cross ratio, the four point function would only be dominated by just a single set of points, and if that's true, then this basically the Cosine equation basically gives us a relation that relates the saddle points at x and 1 minus x. So you have this set of equation. So the first equation just give you a relation between the saddle point at x and 1 minus x, basically the value of m of these two saddle points. The second two equation would basically just relate the classical piece of a structure constant and the one loop piece of structure constant at m hat of x and m hat of 1 minus x. And so recall that our previous conclusion that this phase structure, if x is smaller than 1/2, then m hat is smaller than m hat of x is smaller than m hat. And when x is larger than 1/2, m hat of x is larger than m hat. So now I can take a special value such that x is smaller than 1/2, and I will have m hat of x is smaller than m hat and also smaller than m hat of 1 minus x. So this basically tells us that if we know some information about the structure constant of light operators, we will get some information of the structure constant of the heavy operator. And this equation, this relation is quite similar to Cauchy formula. And that, so Cauchy formula, we call Cauchy formula, if you know some condition on the spectrum of on the spectrum of light operator, you can know the density of states of heavy operator. So and then that, so, so the thing we get here is a similar statement but for structure constant. Okay, so now the statement we get is still not that useful because we just get a relation, but we do not know the classical piece and one loop piece as some light operator. So this equation is not that useful because on one side we don't know, and then we cannot know the other side. But on some special case, we can know the one side, and this equation gives us some non-trivial information on the other side, the heavy operator side. So this is the case when a CFD has a gap on above the vacuum state. And so first we need to assume that a CFD has a vacuum, and not every CFD has a vacuum. For example, Liouville theory does not have a vacuum state, but we need to assume that a CFD has a vacuum, and above the vacuum there is an order C gap. For vacuum state, there is a very natural normalization, is that p for vacuum is zero and one root p for vacuum is one. And so now we need to further assume, okay, first if a vacuum exists, then at x equals zero, the four-point function must dominate by vacuum. This just simply follows from the cluster decomposition, and we need to further assume that the vacuum continues to dominate the four-point function up to some phase transition point xpt, and that should be smaller than 1/2, because we previously shown that there must be, I mean, at the Gaussian symmetric point, the thin dominator the thin dominator four-point function must not be the vacuum, so the phase transition point must be smaller than the Gaussian symmetric point. But we assume vacuum continue to dominate up to xpt, and then if we use these two relations, we can get some classical piece of structure constant and one loop piece of structure constant for some heavy operator, and because we know the left hand side are just given by the value of the vacuum. Okay, and so basically, okay, this is just what I just said. We can know the classical and one loop piece of the structure constant for m that's larger than m hat of 1 minus x phase transition. And this, the way to read this diagram is that suppose the phase transition occur at point 3, then you can read this value. So all the is around 5. So all the p sigma and the q sigma at m that's larger than 5 times m sigma can be determined from the previous Gaussian equation. So recall that the m hat is actually the m hat as a function of x is actually determined by this equation, and there's a dependence of m sigma, and so here I vary the m sigma from 0.01 to up to 12, and actually the m hat of 1 minus x actually does not vary much with this m sigma. So using the Gaussian equation, what we get is a universal form of the classical and one loop structure constant, and here I plot the thing we get for the classical structure constant, and you can see that if m is large, then all these curves are just roughly parallel to each other, and this actually agrees with a bound that previously derived by Malacena, Semestoffi, and Zeboidov, and this is that the structure constant must be in a large m limit must be bounded by 16 to the minus m times c, and if you take log of this formula, that give you p, and this basically tell you that the line are just linear with negative slope, and if you just compute the slope, you will find that the slope equals to log 16. So this behavior actually saturates the bound that derived by these people. So similarly, we can also determine the one loop piece of a structure constant, and it's given by this plot. So the next thing I will do is that I will apply our technique to a very special example. That's the four-point function of twist two, sorry, the four-point function of Z2 twist field correlator. So so we consider this particular correlator, and we can actually this correlator can actually be lifted to a torus partition function. And the way to and also the modular transformation of this torus partition function actually is equivalent to the quotient symmetry on this 4-point function. And the way to understand is that we insert four Z2 twisted operator, and there will be branch cut between pairs of operators. So you have a branch cut from x1 to x2, and another branch cut from x3 to x4. And if you go around the branch cut, you go from one sheet to the other sheet. And now if you connect this branch cut from upper sheet to and lower sheet, you get this torus. And so one of the interesting quantity to study on conformal field theory is the gap above the vacuum state in the spectrum of all the primary operators. And so suppose you have a vacuum state, and we want to find the maximum gap you are allowed to have, such that the first non-trivial primary appear above this gap. And so from our result, we know that because there must be a phase transition that occur at the quotient symmetric point. And if you go beyond the quotient symmetric point, the four-point function must be dominated by some non-vacuum states. So that non-vacuum state must appear in the theory. So the value of the dimension of that non-vacuum state would just naturally give us because that non-vacuum state must appear in the theory, so that the gap must be smaller than the dimension of that non-vacuum state. And if you just plus some number in and evaluate the weight of that non-vacuum state, then what you found is C over 24. And this actually is the same bound as the one that was derived by Hellman.
Is that a function of the cohomology region of the external operator?
No, this M is the internal operator, the dimensional internal operator.
But this is the third point of this correlation function.
Yes, so I relate the correlation function to a torus partition function. So this bond is actually for all the primary, not just the primary that appear in the.
So that the external operator
in the OBE.
Okay, this twist is.
Yeah, the external operator is a twist.
Yeah.
Okay. So the next thing I would show you is I will use that universal formula for structure constant to apply to Z2 twist field correlator, and I can derive the usual Cauchy's formula. So the density state of a single copy theory. Basically, the tensor state of the theory living on the torus can be related to the structure constant of the theory that living on this two-sheet this symmetric part of the OP4 theory, and given by basically this relation, and we can have some universal so by previous study we can have some universal formula for P and Q, so this would give us a universal formula for the tensor state of primary. And the tensor state of all the operator was just given by some convolution of the tensor state of primary. And so previously we need to assume that the vacuum dominates at x equals zero up to some x phase transition. So here we need to assume something similar. We want to assume the vacuum block dominates dominate at tau equals I infinity, but still continue to dominate down to tau equals to I. And this translates into the condition on denser state. It is this condition that the denser state of some of light operator should be smaller than some exponential of 2 pi times h. So this is a typo. This should be for all h less than c over 24. So that's the sparseness condition. So if this condition is true, then so you just apply our formula to, and then we produce the Cauchy formula, and also with some higher order correction. So you have this Cauchy growth piece, and also so this Cauchy growth is universal, and also some non-universal piece. So and this formula holds for all the dimension above c over 12, and this z light is the partition function for the light spectrum, and it's defined by just basically a weighted sum, and of h from zero to some small positive number c epsilon times central charge. So the original Cauchy formula is valid in the region that when h is much larger than the central charge, and this Cauchy formula has an extended region of validation, and it's valid for h larger than c over 24. And if you try to take the large h limit, that's the same as the large m limit. So you can see that roughly these two terms remains the same. But this light partition function would if you plug that in, you will see an exponential decay. So in m, so this term roughly just contribute one, and then you can see that this part and this classical part and one loop part are actually universal. But I mean, if you want to have some extended region of validation, then only universal piece is the cardical piece.
I'm a little confused. The second large brackets, is that in the exponent? That's not.
No. It's not in the exponent. It's outside exponent.
This prefactor to the 1/4. Why doesn't that modify just the 1/√c?
Well, you need to include this into. These two terms can be combined into one term. And
I guess I'm not seeing how the factor in large brackets becomes one.
Oh no! I just said z light becomes one.
Yeah,
this term is still there.
But why didn't Cardi know about this prefactor?
So Cardi derived this factor, and there is a follow up paper by Calips, and he derived the logarithmic correction to Cauchy formula, and this is
so
valid.
This prefactor is known previously.
Yeah, it's known previously. Yes, and this prefactor only will only be universal if you consider h is much larger than c, but if you extend the region of h up down to c over 12. Then this part becomes non-universal because you have another contribution that depends on light spectrum. Okay, and
so is this z light? It does through the Strassmann-Brock decomposition of the twist operator, over interaction of the twist operator.
Yeah, you can derive.
Yeah.
This z light depends on what theory you have.
Okay. Yeah. So my question is, okay, so now that you are considering two decomposition, I mean, one is this channel decomposition, one is the other T-channel decomposition, and if you decompose these four-way functions of the twist operator, then maybe the right enters in the expression. Is that the reason why there is a Z-right in your own formula?
Yes, basically.
Okay.
So for example, if you consider the case that satisfies this condition that the vacuum dominates up to tau equals I, then the z light would the law would just be be given by the one that given by the expansion of vacuum block.
Okay. I see.
Yeah. But if you can assume you can relax your assumption that there can be more states besides the vacuum states that are light, and then you will modify the low edge, the light spectrum. Okay, and the next I will comment on some future directions. So I think the most interesting thing that come out of our result is a question of what's the gravity interpretation of our universal formula for structure constants. For the original Cauchy formula, there's a very nice there's a very nice gravity interpretation. It is that the Cauchy formula just reflects on the box side the entropy of BTZ black hole. And we hope that there can be something similar and a simple classical interpretation of this universal formula of the structure constant. And one hint towards this question is there are actually some very beautiful gravity interpretation of semi-classical blocks. And for example, if you consider the classical block, this function f, in a limit that m sigma and m are very small than one, and they are, I mean, the dimension is still scaled with central charge, but I take the ratio of dimension and central charge to be very small. So this is like an order of limits issue. You first take large central charge and then take this limit. And in this limit there's a correspondence between the classical block and the wall line action in the ADS space. And basically this function f can be computed by you consider some geometry of this wall line. You have four boundary points and two bulk points, and these two bulk points can freely vary, can freely move, and you want to fix the two bulk points such that you minimize the wall line action, and after you do a minimization, you found out that the thing you computed here is exactly equals to the classical block.
So real lines and
what? Some heavy particles. So basically, you just it's just the mass times the length of the wall line. That's the wall line action.
So all the mass.
So you basically consider there's no structure. You basically just consider these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 segments of wall line, and then you assume there are two bulk points, and you vary the bulk points such that the entire action is minimal, and after doing that you found that the thing you compute on this side equals to the classical block. And you may hope that there can be some.
That's just is known by computation.
It's known by computation.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know a physical interpretation. Okay, there's one particular limit you can consider is that you take m, you further take m equals zero, and this actually reduced to a Rei Takanayaki formula of entanglement entropy. So if m is zero, then there's no this internal segment of wall line, and you just have two minimal surface, and that's equals to the Rei Takanayaki formula. And on the left hand side is the entanglement entropy of 2D CFD with two interval.
So m is the mass. Of
m would end up be the mass of the heavy particle.
So in that diagram, the particle that goes just in the bulk is has mass m.
Yes, has mass m. Rough.
The particles at the end of the boundary also.
So m would be the ratio between okay. M would be the ratio between between dimension and the central charge, and when you want to take both to be large, but keep the ratio. And after you take that limit, then in the bulk, the M will proportional to the mass of the heavy particle. Would not exactly equal, but proportional to the mass. And okay, in particular, there's no any structure at this bulk point. You do not put you do not insert any vertex at bulk point. You just assume that these three lines connect at a single point.
And all five lines there have the same mass.
Oh, so in this particular case, I assume the external lines has mass m sigma, and the internal line has mass m. And in general, this relation is true for all these lines have different masses. And so you may try to extend this picture to some more general Kalmogorov block with generic m sigma and m. And one may think of that this particular classical block might correspond to some unsure Hilbert-Einstein action evaluated on some geometry. So our universal formula is actually not on the 4-point function, but actually on the structure constant and 3-point function. So a similar picture would be actually you have three external lines may meet at a point, and the one thought would be you can consider the geometry of three conical deficits that meet at the bulk point, or a three boundary wormhole geometry, and then you consider unsure Hilbert-Einstein action and evaluate on this geometry, and then try to see that in some parameter region do reproduce this universal behavior. Okay.
So that's a conjecture.
Okay, you can say that's a conjecture. Okay. So yeah, I all the things I have to say. Thank you.